The following is an encore episode of Hour One of the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. We hope you enjoy. The following is an encore episode of Hour One of the Turley Frequency with host Kevin Turley. We hope you enjoy.
That's enough. That's enough, Mike. Hello and welcome to the Turley Frequency.
No, you kept me on my toes there. I'm like, he's coming in eventually.
I was waiting for the moment. But anyway, I'm glad that now I know you know what that film music is, but I wonder if anybody listening knows what that famous film soundtrack is, because. It's a well-known piece of music. Probably most of you know who it is. It's, of course, The Great Escape, that famous film from the early 60s, starring a whole battery of famous stars. But in particular, Steve McQueen. Do you remember him?
Oh, yeah.
Who could forget Steve McQueen? I don't know about you, but we were all rooting for Steve McQueen to escape. You know, I mean, that was the whole point of the film, I guess. And the motorbike and the famous trying to get over those bumps and then over the barbed wire. And anyway, I won't spoil it on anybody who's listening. But just to give you the heads up, today I have a story about Steve McQueen. And it's a story which is not particularly well known and may surprise you. Today is the anniversary of Steve McQueen's death. He died in 1980 on this day. He was only 50 years old. But his ending was quite dramatic. And I've termed the story perhaps Steve McQueen's greatest escape. But you're going to have to stick around to the end of the show to find out more about that. How are you today? It's what day is it today? Wednesday? Is it Wednesday today? Yes, it is Wednesday. I have to say I've lost track of time because of our boiler problems. Do you remember yesterday I mentioned to you that our boiler, which is the mechanism by which we heat this house and keep ourselves alive, well, it packed in. And so we haven't really had any heat for the last 24 hours. Now, normally that's not a problem. You just kind of wait for the engineer, the boiler man, to come out and fix it. And yesterday I was debating whether to contact our regular boiler man, because the last time I contacted him, he was so busy, I don't think he could come out or something. And, you know, they're very hard to get. Good plumbers, good boiler men in this part of the world are very hard to come by. And when you get hold of them, you hang on to them. So I was debating in my mind, should I ring him? Should I not? And of course, my wife was saying, ring him. And I was saying, but he's busy and he was busy last time. She said, ring him. I said, but, you know, he won't respond. She said, ring him. So I rang him. He picked up the phone straight away. Hi, Kevin, how are you? I said, I'm fine. I said, I've got problems with the boiler. He says, do you want me to come around and have a look at it? I said, I sure do. He said, when? I said, tomorrow. He said, I'll be there first thing in the morning. Couldn't believe it. Now, I have to say, I had said a little prayer to St. Joseph just before I made that call, because I really didn't think it was going to go so well. So he came around, and I was hoping he would come around before the show started, because we can't afford to pay him as well to come on the show as a guest star, you know, and he would have been rummaging around, crashing into the radiators and sorting stuff out. Anyway, he came just before the show started, and he took a look at it, and he looked at it, and he took it apart. He said, no, I've got to get another part for this. And I said, well, how long is that going to take? And he said, well, If I order it today, you might have it by the weekend. So it was cold last night. I think it's got a. We have just hit the coldest snap of the year. The coldest snap of the year. So, thanks, Mike. Thank you. Thank you. You know, this never happens in the summer, but then I guess we don't put the central heating on in the summer. But the coldest part of the year, and we have no boiler. Mercifully, my wife was out most of last night, so she came home, and I'd already gone to bed. I was trying to keep warm. So if I sound a little bit under the weather, it's just the early stages of frostbite, so don't worry.
Sorry, didn't mean to laugh at your problems.
I'm glad that there is some source of amusement in all of this.
You've got to laugh through the pain. You got to laugh through the pain.
Got to laugh through the pain. Now, talking of laughing through the pain, Mark Twain, the great American wit, is one of my favorite witticisms. You know, he's a great wit. Up there with Oscar Wilde, they were both able to just turn phrases which were gold, you know. And I came across something he said recently about reading health books. Now, I don't know about you, and I don't know, Mike, if this is your case, but if you ever picked up, you know, when you were a kid, these were more around years ago before the internet, every home would have a kind of family medical book, you know, which had lots of, you know, family ailments and how to deal with them and all the rest of it. Now, I was lucky. Yeah. And my mother was a nurse, so she knew exactly what to do with us, which was very little often. But, you know, I remember sitting looking at these books and you'd be reading them and you'd say, I think I suffer from that. And you go to the next page and read something else. And you think, I really think I might have this. And anyway, it was, I mean, for anybody who is a budding hypochondriac, they were disastrous. But Mark Twain had this to say. He said, be careful about reading health books. You may die of a misprint. And although it's a wit, I think it's quite a true one that we can overanalyze these situations. So I am trying at the moment to mind over matter. I'm trying to think it's not really cold, and I'm not really cold either. So if you want to warm me up, you can give me a ring on 888-928-0881 and tell me about the warmth of the sunshine in Lower Alabama today. Or you can text me on 251-928-2111. Or if you've got any remedies for the common cold, everybody's got a remedy for that, right? Mike, I'm sure you have a remedy when your children get the common cold. What do you do with them?
We switch out between, Tylenol and ibuprofen and get them you know, warm drinks, get them a lot of like Gatorade and whatnot, and try to get it out of their system, and you know, put a warm rag over their heads while they lay in bed, and so and that usually does the trick for about a couple of days, and so and they're, you know, and they're good. I mean, kids recover so quickly.
So, they do, don't they? You know, it's one of the things about getting older is that we recover less quickly. It really is. Everything takes longer. But it seems to be. I have a brother who's a doctor, and I often asked him about this, and he says there isn't any cure for it. He's quite dismissive, you know. He says there isn't any cure for it. He says you just got to go to bed for a couple of days, and you'll be fine. Which is fine, but then I always come back with something like, you mean we can send space probes to the furthest part of the universe, but we don't know how to cure the common cold? And he says yes. So so if anybody's got a kind of family tradition about how to cure it or how to offset,
but I think your brother-in-law is onto something. I mean, that really is when you're sick. The best medicine is rest. I mean, because our bodies, you know, can naturally heal themselves. You know, you get cut, you get a scrape, it over time it heals itself.
That's true.
We're like reptiles in that sense. You know, only, you know, you chop our heads off, we're gone. But you know.
But I think, you know, when you were younger, I mean, sure, it's true of your children. You can put them to bed for 2 days and nobody notices, you know, they're in bed, they're fine, they're reading their books or listening to music, whatever they do. But as an adult, when you've got things to do, right, there
That's
isn't
the
anybody
worst.
To tuck
yeah.
you in. Spending 2 days in bed isn't really an option a lot of the time. And I know it prolongs things and you probably spread your germs around as you're moving around. But, you know, you're going to have to be, you know, you're going to have to look after yourself a bit. But anyway, enough of this talk of maladies and malingering. The other thing which I found rather depressing today the news item. One of the top news items over this side of the Atlantic, I'm sure it's over on your side too, which was that Google released its top searches for 2022. Have you come across this? Have you, Mike? Have you seen this?
I'm sorry, what is it again? I was checking something.
It's Google have released their top searches, you know, so the thing
searches.
That people searched most for. And both in the UK and the US, the top trending search of 2022 is something called Wordle. Have you heard of this?
Oh, yeah. I sure have. Ellen, our station manager, plays it all the time with her family.
Well, I'm glad you told me that because I think it's a very worthy and worthwhile use of our time. And I wasn't going to say anything else on that score. I must admit, though, Mike, I didn't know what it was whenever I came across this. Most of the other things on this list I kind of know, but I thought, Wordle, what is that? But it's some sort of game. So obviously people are using the internet to play a game, which is very popular. So, I mean, it's probably like Scrabble or something. But the number two in the United States was election results, which, again, is not a surprise with everything that's happened in 2022. Three threw me. And I'm not going to ask you to guess, Mike, because these are such random thoughts. The number three one was Betty White.
Oh, yeah, the famous actress comedian. Yeah, sure. But she, I mean, passed away. Then she passed away, let's see, was it earlier this year?
It was the very end of 2021.
That's right.
I mean, she was well known and all the rest of it.
Of course.
But I wouldn't have thought that she was sort of number three in the top Google top trending searches for 2022. I just that threw me. Number four didn't. It was Queen Elizabeth. That again. And then there were more predictable searches: the Ukraine, Mega Millions, Powerball numbers, and so forth. So that was sort of predictable that people are looking it up for the latest news or for help with their games. Or to find out if they had become a billionaire, which there's only one person became. The top Google's top trending news searches of 2022 were pretty predictable. Election results, the death of the Queen, Ukraine, Powerball numbers again, various hurricanes and monkeypox. But at number 10 was Roe versus Wade, which I thought was interesting. But the top trending peoples, let me see if you can get this one, Mike. And this is
top
random, okay?
People.
Who would you say is the person that was most searched for on Google in the United States in 2022?
The most searched for Google person in 2022? Donald Trump.
you're onto something there, because I would have said that.
Biden, right?
Biden,
yeah.
Trump, or Nancy Pelosi, somebody like that, right?
Right. Or maybe that, I don't know, you just said that the Queen was number four, right?
That was huge. Her death was number four in the news section. But in terms of trending people, she didn't make the top 10.
Wow, she didn't.
No, but neither did Biden or Trump.
Okay.
If I tell you who did make the top three, you'll get the gist of what people are searching for. Number three was, no, not at all. Number three was Amber Heard.
Oh, yeah, the Johnny right? Depp, Johnny Depp's
right?
ex-girlfriend.
Number two was Will Smith.
Okay, I could see that, the slap, I forgot about that.
That's right. And number one was Johnny Depp.
How about that? Johnny Depp, number one. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I think...
there was...
I mean, I don't know what that tells us about the United States. I mean, the British side were no better. I looked at the British top Google searches, and it was the same kind of obsession with celebrity and trivia. Johnny Depp was number two in England.
Wow, okay.
And Will Smith was number three, and Amber Heard was number five. I have to admit, I'd never heard of Amber Heard until this year. But I had heard of Johnny Depp, obviously. So it just shows you that people are people, and they are not searching for important things. They're searching for trivial not trivial, but gossipy. I suppose it's gossip, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's court cases with the rich and famous. Nothing is out of bounds on that. Now, I don't know if you heard the news just today. I heard this about, we were praying recently, as you know, for Father Otis Young, you know, the priest who died in,
yes.
I think it's Covington.
Covington, Louisiana. Yeah,
that's right. And he had his funeral just the other day. And it was very interesting what was reported. I found this on a secular website called NOLA.com. And it was talking about his, his prayerful life that this man led. But what was also very interesting was that Father Otis Young faithfully wore the brown scapula, right? The brown scapula, for anybody who's listening who doesn't know, is a piece of cloth or a medal, which is a sign of devotion to Our Lady. It's very appropriate. We speak about this on the eve of the Immaculate Conception. And that devotion came about through a vision to an English monk, or English friar, St. Simon Stock, back in the 11th century. And the devotion carries with it certain promises that anybody who wears the brown scapula will be spared the fires of hell. Well, anyway, the person officiating at Father Young's funeral said that Father Otis had many of these, and the priest held up one of the scapulas that he had, and he said that Father Otis had been wearing this one when he died, and it was the only thing that survived the fire. You know, the bodies were burned. That drew quite an odd murmur from the congregation. And I don't know about you, Mike, but I'm not surprised.
Wow.
Yeah, wow. The right reaction.
I've heard of a similar story where there was a bomb, Kevin, that went off. I think it was in Mexico somewhere near the shrine where they have the Our Lady of Guadalupe. And a bomb went off in front of, I think it was in Mexico, but a bomb went off in front of the statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary and did not affect it the least bit.
That's right.
Everything around it was destroyed, but it did not affect it in the least bit. And I'll tell you something else interesting, too, is that, so my cousin, he attended the University of Alabama back in the early 2010, I think 2011 was freshman year, and there was a tornado, tornado that came through. It was an F5 tornado that came through Tuscaloosa, where the university is, and destroyed, totaled Tuscaloosa. I mean, everything. They had to pretty much rebuild the city. And it came through, and my cousin and his roommates were downstairs in the basement, and it ripped through their house and destroyed everything in their room except for a statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary and all of the Catholic elements, you know, like the crucifix, everything that he had in his room that was of Catholic nature.
Yes. It really doesn't surprise me, Mike. We'll remember Father Otis and also the lady who was killed with him today. But I thought that that was a nice little footnote to that very sad story. And I don't know about you, Mike, but I am very happy to be wearing a brown scapula. I need it.
All right, I need to go ahead and get myself another one.
It's to save us from the fires of hell, and in Father Otis's young case, it didn't burn. That's the interesting thing. Now, talking of burning, when we come back, I have a burning desire to speak with Dale Alquist, who is, well, to say he's an expert on G.K. Chesterton is an understatement. He is the greatest living Chestertonian today, for my money, and he has written so many books on the man, spoken about him in so many lectures. I can't wait to pick his brains about what G.K. Chesterton would have thought of Advent and Christmas. You're not going to want to miss this. This is going to be good fun. So stay with me back after these words.
Winding your way down on Baker Street, light in your head and dead on your feet. Well, another crazy day.
Architecture is the most practical and most dangerous of the arts. All the other arts we have to live with. They are things we have to live with, and some have even said, as regards some kinds of music and painting, that they are things they could live without. But architecture is not a thing only that we have to live with, it is a thing we have to live in. We live with it as Jonah lived with the whale. Jonah could not see the monster, and there is a great deal to be said for living in the most hideous house you can see in the landscape, as that is the one place where you will be unable to see it. I have before me...
This is the voice of G.K. Chesterton. That's the great man himself, and I love that line. I'd thought of it myself, but he puts it beautifully, that it's always best to live in the ugliest house in the street because all the other houses you look out upon. And that is a very Chestertonian thought. Now, I have with me Dale Alquist, who needs no introduction, I think. I've got a list of his many, many achievements in life. I mean, he is the greatest living Chestertonian. That's probably how I would sum Dale up. I've had the pleasure of meeting him when he came to London once. And he is as charming and as interesting in real life as I'm sure he will be with us today. Dale, welcome to the Turley Frequency.
Well, God bless you, Kevin. It's a great pleasure to be with you. It's great to hear Chesterton's voice in the introduction there.
Isn't it? Isn't it just? Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because his death probably cut off a burgeoning career with the BBC. They loved him and they loved his voice and they loved his radio manner. But unfortunately, ill health and finally his own mortality put pay to that just as the radio age was getting going. But we still have of his voices, as you know.
The sad thing is BBC didn't save enough of the recordings that make with him. He recorded with him for almost 3 years, and I think they only saved about two or three of the recordings. But he did, in fact, change the course of radio talking because he talked with such a conversational voice, and that was a new thing. That most radio announcers up until that time would speak like they were speaking in a public address system in an outdoor stadium. They'd shout it into the radio like that. And whereas Chesterton actually had someone sitting across from him when he did his recordings and spoke in a conversational voice because people were listening to the radio in their living room and he wanted to be sitting there with them.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right. Just on that point, I mean, the BBC are guilty also of losing all C.S. Lewis Screwtip Letter broadcasts as well, which were broadcast, as you know, during the, I think in 1940, during the Blitz. So, yes, the best has been lost. Now, Dale, for anybody listening And we will have people who are listening on AM and FM and just tuning in wondering, who is this guy? How would you sum up? I know it's difficult. I know it's really difficult. That's why I'm asking you to do it. How would you sum up G.K. Chesterton? How would you give us a thumbnail sketch of the man and his life?
Well, let's start by describing him as a giant, both physically and figuratively. He was a giant in terms of his intellectual capacity and accomplishment, his writing output, just an incredible, prolific output, but really one of the great thinkers of the early 20th century who put it all together and was such a complete thinker that it left him no choice but to become Catholic, because he said that was the summit of thinking. And he said, you know, to become Catholic doesn't mean leaving off thinking. It means learning how to think. And so he's one of the great Catholic converts of the 20th century, and eloquent and witty and joyful and fat.
Absolutely. I mean, just to give, I mean, that was brilliant, Dale. That's a lovely, just to put him in context. I mean, he was born in 1874 and he died in 1936, and he became a Catholic 100 years ago this year. It was, I think, July 1922 that he finally joined the Catholic Church. And we'll maybe touch on that in a minute. But you're absolutely right about the giant, because what people forget is, I think he was 6'4", right?
Right.
From a very early age, and he was probably about 20 stone for most of his life.
Yeah, 20 stone, as we Americans would probably say, something like 300 pounds.
300 pounds, he, right? Yeah. Well, thank you for the translation. We would say 20 stone. I mean, he was a big man. And but the thing is, and the thing which you have mapped, Dale, very well in your series of books over the years, is, I mean, Chesterton is not a writer. He's not even a celebrity. He's a universe, right? You kind of enter into this Chestertonian universe because, I mean, if I can recommend any book that anybody wants to just understand something of him, I recommend Dale's Night of the Holy Ghost, A Short History of G.K. Chesterton, published by Ignatius Press and the Augustine Institute. It's an absolutely, if I may say, a brilliant summary of a man who is very difficult to summarize. And the reason is, which you have outlined in this book, is because he produced so much. I mean, there is not one genre of literature that he didn't try his hand at and succeeded at. I mean, and you have made a very good stab at trying to work out how many pieces of journalism he wrote. But, I mean, the jury's probably still out on that. Do we really know how many pieces of journalism he wrote?
Well, I'll tell you, Kevin, we are at the point now where I think we have a handle on it, because our good friend Geir Hostis has been spending the last 35 years working on a bibliography of all of Chesterton's writings, and it's been a group project. Many of us have participated in hunting down those obscure one-off articles in strange journals, and we think we have at least 99% of them, and Geir has just published his bibliography of Chesterton. And the bibliography, Kevin, is three volumes. It's 1,200 pages. There are 44,000 entries.
Wow. Wow. And I mean, you've read most of it, right?
Yeah, but I'm never going to say I've read all of it, because anybody who says that should go to confession.
Well, if they have read all of it, they should contact you and give you the insight as to why they're doing what they're doing. I mean, but you have, I mean, you know, as I said, that book, The Night of the Holy Ghost, is a brilliant read, but it's also a very good overview of his work. And I found it particularly fascinating because one of the things that I mean, I've been a Chestertonian fan for all my adult life, but one of the things that I found difficult was to kind of get a handle, as we say, on what he was doing and when he was doing it. Because, as you know, a lot of his published works, you're not quite sure where they are in the chronology. So, for example, I was reading that collection of essays. I think it's called The Defendant, that early collection. But I didn't realize it was one of his first stabs at journalism because it is so accomplished. I mean, one of the things about Chesterton, and you know, the word genius is thrown around too liberally these days, but it's not enough, really, for Chesterton and his thought and his writing and all the rest of it. But one of the things that really struck me, having tried my hand at writing over the years, is how fully formed Chesterton was as a writer and a thinker at a very young age. Would you agree?
Oh, I absolutely agree. You compare him to Athena coming out of the head of Zeus, fully formed. I mean, it seems like when he started his writing career, he was already accomplished as a writer. He just was, all of the skill was already there and on display.
And where do you think that, I mean, was that, where did that come from? I mean, he read, obviously, he was a keen and voracious reader, but I mean, is it just natural genius? Was it just his genius?
Well, I think there's a combination of genius. He could compare him to Mozart or Bach in that way, but both Mozart and Bach did a lot of composing, and their composing made them better composers. And Chesterton just did an awful lot of writing, and that was, he was developing his skill as a young man, just filling up notebooks with eloquence.
You're listening to Dale Elquist, who is the president of the Society of Gilbert Keith Chesterton. He's also the creator of TV series, and he edits a magazine devoted to the thought of the great man called Gilbert Magazine, and he has authored and edited more books than I care to start referencing. Otherwise, we'll be here for the rest of the show on this. If anybody has a question about Chesterton, let's say Chesterton is one of those figures that you've heard of, but there's something that you wanted to ask, where to start, or about Father Brown, or something. Now's the moment to call in and ask Dale a question, 888-928-0881, or text me and I'll happily field those questions for you on 251-928-2111. In all your time, Dale, researching, well, first of all, there was a question I wanted to ask you. I remember I woke up this morning and I thought, I've got this question. I want to ask Dale. Dale, how did you come across Gilbert Keith Chesterton?
Well, I do get that question an awful lot. And it's funny. You have to go back to the dark ages, 1970s, when no one was reading Chesterton, but there were just a few out there. And I was a big C.S. Lewis fan already as a young man. And, someone saw me reading a C.S. Lewis book. I was reading Mere Christianity, and he said to me, "You like C.S. Lewis?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I love C.S. Lewis." He said, "Have you ever read G.K. Chesterton?" And I said, "I've never heard of G.K. Chesterton." He said, "If you like C.S. Lewis, you'll love G.K. Chesterton." And then he said the immortal words, "In fact, if you read Chesterton, you don't even need to read C.S. Lewis, because all of C.S. Lewis is inside Chesterton." And of course, that was a blasphemous remark in my opinion. But it stuck with me, and it was about 3 years later when as soon as he told me that, then I started seeing Chesterton's name, and started seeing C.S. Lewis himself referring to Chesterton, which I had never noticed before. But I picked up the book that was most influential in C.S. Lewis's life, and that was The Everlasting Man. That was the book that really brought C.S. Lewis to the Christian faith, and that's the one I started with, which is a very difficult book to start with, but that got me hooked. And it's a funny story, because I read The Everlasting Man on my honeymoon, and so my wife says that the three of us have gotten along pretty good for our entire marriage. So.
It's been an everlasting love affair ever since.
Yeah, that's right.
But you're so right about C.S. Lewis, because I think I encountered C.S. Lewis before I really got into Chesterton. And I remember when I got into Chesterton, probably a bit like you, I started thinking, oh, wait a minute, I now know where Lewis got that from.
Where
all writers pinch, we know that. But I pinched it from there. But the other thing is, I think that Chesterton, Lewis was an atheist, or certainly agnostic. And then he said that famous line, a young agnostic can't be too careful about what he reads. And what he was referring to was G.K. Chesterton. But you must have seen that over the years, Dale, people who encounter G.K. Chesterton, and they may not be Christian, they may not be conservative, they may not be interested in his view of life, but he tends to sort of absorb them, you know, that he's like some sort of gravitational force. You can't resist him, right?
Oh, it's true. I have encountered them. In fact, I started a list, which I should have started earlier, but there's over 500 people on the list of people who've become Catholic because at some point they encountered Chesterton, and he helped escort them into the Catholic Church. And one of the books I edited is called My Name is Lazarus, and it's 34 testimonials of people who became Catholic because of reading Chesterton. And we have former Muslims, Jews, atheists, agnostics, and Protestants of all stripes who found that Chesterton opened them up towards the Catholic Church.
Was he instrumental in your path to Rome?
Well, yeah, he was the full reason. I was a Baptist, and I was the farthest thing from being a Catholic that you can imagine. And Chesterton broke down all those barriers and just escorted me to the door of the Catholic Church. But it took him 16 years to do it.
Well, it took him quite a while as well. I mean, maybe we can talk about that in the next segment, because, as I say, we've got the 100th anniversary. But it wasn't all plain sailing, and he had a wife who had certain misgivings, and Francis, and we can talk about that. Dale, are you okay to stay for another segment and take any questions?
I'll be happy
to. Come through?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So this is your chance to speak to Dale Alquist, president of the Society of Gilbert Keith Chesterton and all-round expert on all matters G.K. Chesterton. We will come back and discuss Chesterton more, Chesterton the mystic, I think, and in particular Chesterton's path to Rome, which landed him in a very makeshift chapel 100 years ago, deciding to become a Catholic. Back after these words. Welcome back to the Turley Frequency here live and exclusive on Archangel Radio, and we are discussing all things Chestertonian with no less than Dale Alquist, a true Chestertonian aficionado, a man who knows what he doesn't know about G.K. Chesterton probably has not yet been discovered. Dale, I got you on this morning because I wanted to talk to you in particular. It was just an excuse to chat to you, really. But I wanted to talk to you in particular about Advent and Christmas, because Chesterton loved to feast, right? But he also understood the mystery of the whole Christmas story. And no better guide, I would have thought, to give us some hints on how to enjoy and experience Advent and Christmas. What would you say?
Well, I think one of the things that he lamented, and I think this is a major problem today, is, of course, the people celebrating Christmas before Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of observing Advent as a time of truly waiting for this great celebration and then beginning the great feast when the day comes, but to not feast before the feast arrives. And he lamented it particularly because of the fact, as a journalist, he had to write about these things before it was Christmas, you know, because he had to write about Christmas before it was Christmas, because that's when the articles were published, you know, at Christmas. And he didn't like having to think so much about the celebration during the fact he was in that time, really a time of penance. Advent is like Lent before Easter, and I think we forget that too often.
I have to say, though, that the name Chesterton is not often linked with penitence or mortification. One thinks of feasting and jollity and having a good time. But, I mean, you know his life better than most. I mean, would you say there was a hidden mortified side to him?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And you're right. It's one of the things people don't think of with Chesterton. But he talks about the fact that we've lost the whole idea of repentance. And he says especially a public repentance. And, you know, Advent and Lent, those are public times of repentance, when we're kind of showing the fact that we're in a stage of penance to the rest of the world. And, you know, our fasting is something that we make known. We don't do certain things, and we let everyone around us be aware of that, so that they're not embarrassed by serving us food that we're not supposed to eat during a time of penance. But but his other idea of penance is that the great sacrament that everyone forgets about is confession, and Chesterton writes some marvelous things about confession. And there's some personal anecdotes about the fact that confession was a difficult thing for him because he had such a hard time fitting into the confessional. he was afraid he was going to walk away with the whole confessional when he left. But he said, but he says, when a man steps out of the confessional, he's 5 minutes old, because his whole life has just started over again. And what a beautiful image that is about confession.
I mean, that's probably, in my mind, what's linking Chesterton to Advent and Christmas, because he never lost that sort of he did lose it initially. He got sidetracked. But as he grew in, when he met Francis, became a Christian and then became a Catholic, he seemed to grow into innocence in a way.
Yes.
You know, do you know what I mean?
Yep. Yeah. He recovered that childlike sense of wonder that really is what Christ talked about. Unless you become like a child, you can't enter the kingdom of heaven. And Chesterton did become childlike in his sense of wonder at God's goodness and God's creation, and looking at each day as if it's the first day of creation. That's a mystical outlook, and it takes a spiritual experience to become childlike.
And yet, I was looking at your latest work last night, which is just published by Ignatius Press this year, The Story of the Family, G.K. Chesterton on the Only State That Creates and Loves Its Own Citizens. And, I have read a lot of Chesterton, but I'm always, the way you've set it out is wonderful, because there's so many quotes from rather obscure, his G.K. Weekly or the Illustrated London News, pieces of journalism which outside of your books never get put anywhere. But what really shocked me was how prophetic his writing was over 100 years ago. He saw all the modern problems in regard to the family laid out. So he may have been growing in innocence, but there was a real prophetic nature to a lot of his writing.
Amen. And it is astounding how prophetic his writing is. And the great paradox, the great juxtaposition, is that he was wise and innocent. He was as innocent as the lamb, but as wise as the serpent, like Christ tells us we have to be. And, Joseph Pierce's great biography of Chesterton is called Wisdom and Innocence. And to put those two things together is the rare combination. And that's what Chesterton is able to achieve. It's interesting because his first two Father Brown books. One was The Innocence of Father Brown, and the second one was The Wisdom of Father Brown. And the character of Father Brown sort of epitomizes Chesterton as being this priest that no one thinks knows anything because he's so good. But of course, he knows way more than anyone else because he understands the heart of man.
Yes, and we spoke a bit about that yesterday on the show, because I was talking about Monsignor John O'Connor, who, as you know, was the model for that. And also, going back to what you were saying about confession, it was really even when he was an Anglican, understanding that the priest, through Monsignor O'Connor, he understood that this priest was wise in a way that a layman couldn't be because of those hours right. spent listening to unspeakable evils in the confessional. But why did you, at this time, decide to sort of set forth Chesterton's thought on the family? I mean, it's a brilliant book, first of all, and I really enjoyed it. But why the family at this time?
Well, you know, I had a really good reason for doing it. Ignatius Press asked me to do it.
The best reason any writer has.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, that is the issue. Chesterton showed that he was worried that the family, he said, not only was fading into the background, but was fading from the background itself, that the attack on the family would be the destruction of a whole civilization. If you have strong families, you have a strong society. If you have weak families, you have a weak society. And he says there's only one force strong enough to replace the family, and that's going to be the state. And that's what he warned about, that the state would rush in and start filling all the functions of the family. And we start to see that through our public education system, through strange reaching in of the welfare state into the private home, and the nanny state. Chesterton was very prophetic on all these things and how people would lose their rights and their freedom if they don't protect their families.
That's right. And I mean, I think it's fair to say that although he was on his way to Rome spiritually, it was really his thinking around the family and linking it to eugenics, linking it to birth control, abortion, all the things that were just as much sort of in the public discourse then as they are today. But it was understanding that the church somehow was the last defender of the family that really tipped him over the edge, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. When he saw the Anglican Church starting to get wobbly on things like contraception and divorce, and unable to state what the right position should be, he said these are the most important things. And in many ways, he said it was the Anglicans who helped him more than anything to become Catholic because of their wobbly doctrines.
Now, I know you've recently led a pilgrimage, I guess you could call it, of Chestertonians to various sites in England. What is your favorite Chestertonian site in this country?
Well, I have to say, of course, it's Chesterton himself, his grave in Beaconsfield, where he lies with his wife. And I visited it for the first time 20 years ago. It was one of the great emotional experiences for me to kneel at his grave and pray for his intercession, and he answered my prayers that day. I'll tell you that. And so every time I'm there with him, I just have a rush of great peace and spiritual uplift.
For anybody who doesn't know, Chesterton, after about 10 years of marriage, approximately, he left London with his wife. They didn't have children, and they moved to a small market town, I guess you'd call it, about 40 miles outside London, Beaconsfield, which I don't know about what you think, but there's still a lot of what Chesterton would have known there in Beaconsfield. It hasn't changed that much, surprisingly, in 100 years. I mean, it's still recognizably.
The old center of the town is much the same. And so, the things that he would have seen are still there.
And even the houses that he lived in are still there.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you know the people who own Overodds, and they showed me around the other house.
Top Meadow.
And I had a tour of that. And I could just see him standing by the fireplace. I mean, it was absolutely uncanny. They were so generous in showing me around. And you could look out the windows and see the garden where so many photographs were taken of Chesterton and Frances, his wife. It's all still there. And he still... still sort of haunts these streets, I think. But for me, Fleet Street and the sort of pubs around Fleet Street, every time I go past there, I can't help thinking of Chesterton sitting in one of those pubs, writing his copy for his various newspapers. Did you have anybody on your recent trip who was there for the first... Sorry, I can't hear you, Dan.
I was going to say, that's where you and I met. It was in one of those pubs.
We met at
the Cheddar Cheese. Yes,
the old Cheddar Cheese. We did, and no better place to meet. It's a place which has a great literary pedigree, and I hope one day we will meet again there, Dale.
Yeah,
but on your recent trip, were there any newbies? Anybody who for the first time was experiencing Chesterton's England?
It was an abbreviated pilgrimage because. We didn't get to have a full pilgrimage with as many people as we had originally planned. So it was a much smaller group, but there were a few folks who were seeing the Chesterton sites for the first time, and they were deeply moved, and they certainly it was a privilege to be with them. It was great to see it all through their eyes as they saw it for the first time. It's really fun to be part of something like that.
Now, for anybody listening who you have whetted their appetite about Chesterton, Dale, what would be the text that you would point them to as a primer, a beginner's text? Now, I will save your blushes and say that the non-Chesterton text should be Dale Alquist's Night of the Holy Ghost, published by Ignatius Press. Start there. But of the great man himself, what books would you say are the most accessible and the quickest way into the beginning of that great universe, which is G.K. Chesterton?
Well, you know, certainly the books that have to be read at some point would be his Orthodoxy and Everlasting Man. However, I don't recommend people start with those books. It's good to get a feel of him as a writer first and to get adjusted to his style and learn how to let him read you rather than you reading him. And so I recommend a book of essays to start with. And I think if they're going to start with pure Chesterton rather than one of my introductory books, and that would be it's called In Defense of Sanity, The Best Essays of G.K. Chesterton. That's a good place to start. But then, you know, you just mentioned this book on the family, The Story of the Family. I edited the book, but it really is pure Chesterton. And I that's another good place to start. If you want to just read pure Chesterton, read The Story of the Family.
In short, Dale, I mean, you could really start anywhere, but be warned. Once started, you'll never finish. This is a literary universe which has no beginning, no end. It's like The Man Who Was Thursday, in a sense, you know, which is this kind of great surrealist comedy, which people are still trying to work out. And I can't help thinking that even when we're long gone, Dale, people will be still trying to work out G.K. Chesterton's genius, and much to their chagrin, because I don't think there's any end to it. Where can people find out more about you and your work? We haven't spoken about your work in education, Dale. I'm afraid we're running out of time, but where can people find out about G.K. Chesterton, first of all, and then more about your work and the Chesterton Academies that you're setting up?
Yeah, Kevin, everyone please go to chesterton.org, chesterton.org. You'll learn about the work of the Chesterton Society, including our work in education, and about Gilbert Magazine and some of the introductory stuff and how they can get a hold of us there. It's a website with much Chesterton wealth to it. But don't go to Chesterton.com, because then you'll get hydraulic valves.
Okay. Dale, it's been an absolute pleasure having on you on the show. I hope you will come back again and spread some of that Chesterton joy once more.
Oh, I'd be delighted to. God bless.
Thank you, Dale. When we come back, we are going to be praying the Divine Mercy Chaplet. Stay with me.